Public Affairs, today, June 5, 2003. And, committee, we have a public hearing only today on House Bill 3639. And this is an issue that's had a lot of different twists and turns and a lot of complexities to it. So I wanted to make sure that the committee was provided some an introduction to the concept, to the issues, to the bill today, and you'll find out through the various testimony you'll hear today is that there are quite a few issues still to be resolved, and it's really going to be the work of this committee to make sure that we can bring something together if that is the desire of the committee members to continue bringing this forward. So first, to help us with this concept and the introduction of the bill, I ask Representative Williams and Representative Morgan to come forward. And just so you know, after that we'll hear from Mylea Christensen with PEB, and then we'll be asking Legislative Council to walk us through the bill a bit, explain the differences between this bill and the Senate version of the same issue. And then we'll look for testimony of others, seeing where that takes us. So with that, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I'm a state representative for House District 2. And Representative Williams and I were wanting to just set the stage for you in as you deliberate what the bill is all about.
Representative Morgan, if I can just stop you a minute. I don't think I opened a public hearing on this, did I?
Oh, that would be an excellent idea.
Did you? Yeah, not really. Well, then open a public hearing on House Bill 3639.
Your formality.
Yes, these details, you kind of...
What I want to talk to you a little bit about is what the need for the bill is and how we came to be in the place that you have the bill sitting before you. One of the big issues that the legislature faces this session is the cost accountability issue in the K-12 system. And as you know, the K-12 funding part of the budget, which is known as the state school fund, is the largest single piece of the state general fund spending. So it has a profound impact on state spending overall. And if you just consider that piece of the pie that goes into the state school fund, about 85% of that money goes to pay for salaries and the attendant cost to salaries that are related to payroll within the system. The biggest cost drivers, in the Ways and Means process, of course, we've been looking at the dynamics of the way the money's spent within the K-12 system. And two of the things that emerged as the biggest cost drivers, the things that increase the cost to the greatest extent in K-12, are the public employees retirement system and the cost of providing health care benefits to the people that work in the K-12 system. Well, the work that we have done this session on the public employees retirement system is very well known. And this is the piece that will attempt to deal with the issue of rising health care costs. This bill is being addressed concurrently, or this issue is being addressed concurrently, both on the Senate side and the House side. And the bills that are moving are the result of a work group that's taken place almost since the beginning of the session, and Representative Backlund's been a part of that work group. We are a group of folks that, on both the House and the Senate side, deal with education policy, and people from the Ways and Means Policy area and people from the Governor's Office. Representative Williams has also been involved in the discussions from the beginning as we brought this issue forward. And part of the beginnings of the discussion were that we were trying to get a kind of a high-level look at whether there was the potential for savings in this area without going into a lot of work and expense to try to figure that out. And so we brought the Public Employees Benefit Board into the discussions and asked them to do kind of a quick and dirty analysis to see whether this would be a path that would indeed be worth walking down in terms of the fiscal savings that would be available to the system. And through that analysis, we did decide that this would be a fruitful path to take. But we realized that if we were going to actually arrive at any meaningful numbers about the potential for savings, we were going to have to take a much more detailed look than that high-level look that we took to try to figure out what the fiscal impact was going to be. And that process is happening as we speak. What we've done is have PEB sit down with the Department of Education, the information systems specialists in the Department of Education, and between them they devised a computer-based, a web-based survey that was sent out to all the school districts in the state that asked them to send back very specific information about the coverage, the health care coverage that they offer and the cost of that coverage. 70% of the districts in the state have returned that information to us, and the Department of Education is in the final stages of compiling that information right now. We're hoping that tomorrow that information will be transferred down to the Legislative Fiscal Office, and those folks will begin work on the fiscal analysis so that we can come up with some kind of a reasoned and logical and with a rational trail leading up to it number that we can expect to see a bill such as House Bill 3639, what the impact will be on the health insurance area. I can't stress enough to the committee the importance of this bill and the importance to the fiscal side of the K-12 discussion that this bill is going to have. This is, we're very hopeful, going to allow us to free up money that's currently tied up in health care costs in the system and allow the system to redirect that money into towards other budget priorities. And that's going to be very important to us this time as we try to make the best use of this CARES general fund thing that we have to work with. I would hope that as you work through this that you are very accepting of the fact that this is a huge and important bill that will come out of this session, both from the point of view of the policy change that will be put in place as a result of it, but also because of the ability and the flexibility that it will give us in the ways and means process. And you're going to have a definitely an interesting path that you're going to walk down here as you work through the issues in the bill. And what I'd like to do now is turn this over to Representative Williams to kind of give you a little bit of the policy side of the discussions that we've been going through.
Thank you, Representative Morgan, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It has been my pleasure to work with Representative Morgan, the work group, and others in the building as this discussion has sort of moved forward. That originated out of a sense, I think, among several of us at least, that it bore investigating the possibility of statewide pooling for providing these kind of health care benefits in a manner that was similar to the manner that these benefits are provided to state employees through the Public Employee Benefit Board. And that was, I think, a starting point in the discussions about how would one accomplish that, and were there, in fact, the likelihood of savings to be achieved. And as Representative Morgan has pointed out, there has been a fair amount of work done to date in an effort to put some parameters around figuring out what that would work like and what it would look like. And the bill that's in front of you, I think both Representative Morgan and I would agree, is a template for this committee to further that discussion. You're going to hear from some people later today behind us who will be able to give you probably a better technical assessment of this bill and its particulars, and some that will raise concerns about certain portions of this bill and the way it's written. And I think both Representative Morgan and I would acknowledge that that's a process that is exactly what we had hoped would occur, that this committee would operate to some degree as the refiner's fire to evaluate this data and make this concept an even better, more effective concept. But simply at the top end of the discussion, the policy issue here is really one that's rather simple. You have 198 school districts around the state which are in a situation where they are obligated to provide health insurance for their employees. And they do it in a variety of different ways. There are some pools that currently exist, and you'll hear from some of those people, I'm sure, today. There are other districts who do it themselves and go out and contract directly for providing the insurance. There are some who are self-insured. But in that mix, what you have is a number of different plans with a number of different options with smaller groups of people who are essentially insured. And therefore, with the smaller pool, the risk factors increase, the cost of administration is increased, and the price of the insurance is higher. And benefits at times are lower. And I say higher not in any individual case, but in the broad expense to which we are studying. And to the extent that the state is providing 70%+ of the K-12 funding, it did seem reasonable and appropriate that we begin to look at what we're actually spending that money on and where we can find efficiencies. And so the concept is one that's essentially modeled after the Public Employee Benefits Board concept. Some of you know the history of the Public Employee Benefits Board. It used to be two programs. It was the SEB and the BUB program, and it eventually came together. But in a program that insures as many lives as that program does, they do it at a very low administrative expense in a very reasonable manner. And for many of you who are on that same program that I'm on through the Public Employee Benefits Board, it's a pretty good benefit at a pretty good level. And so that was sort of the starting point for this discussion. Actuaries have looked at this, and there are going to be differing opinions, but I want to just fundamentally explain and state what I think is sort of the common sense approach. If any of you were going to be starting a business that would require the construction of operations in every county in this state, would you let each one of those operations in each individual county go out and attempt to contract individually for its health plan? Or would you, if you were a Safeway or a McDonald's or an Intel or whoever else you were, decide that you were going to have a single streamlined plan to provide health insurance using the value of all of those people in the pool to both broaden the experience rating of the pool and streamline the administrative expense associated with managing that plan? And that is what this bill does. Now, there is a companion bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 6, that takes a bit of a different approach, but is generally headed in the same direction. And there are differences in the way the boards are structured, and I think you're going to hear probably some testimony about the appropriate way to structure the board. I think all of those things ought to be subject to discussion. I think generally people feel comfortable that the PEB board has a proper balance between management and labor in negotiating that benefit. And I think it would be Representative Morgan and my intent to ensure that this board that managed this education benefit board would also have a proper balance to where both sides were represented in a bargain for process of establishing a good health benefit at a reasonable cost for the system. Another significant difference between the Senate bill and the House bill is in the House bill that's before you, it requires a fairly high threshold to decide if you're going to get out of the pool. The Senate bill lets a lot of people out. If you're a self-insured, it lets you out. If you're in a particular kind of trust program, it lets you out. You don't have to be part of the pool. The bill that's in front of you says that you can get out of the pool if your expense on providing the benefit is less than what the pool is offering, including cost of the administration of that plan on your own. And it also requires if you're out, you're out with everybody that you would otherwise insure. Many districts have different kinds of insurance and plans available to different bargaining units within the district. What you don't want is what I've learned over this last several months in learning a little bit more about insurance is the process of adverse selection, where they put the expensive people in your pool and keep the less expensive people in their own pool. That ends up driving up the cost for everybody in the pool and lowering the cost of the people who don't want to give you their cheap people to insure. So what this plan requires is that if you're going to be out of the pool, you're out of the pool with everybody in your district. You can't keep your expensive unit in the pool and your inexpensive unit someplace else. It requires that everybody is either in or out. And it's a methodology of avoiding adverse selection. And the idea, frankly, of having a threshold that says if you're less expensive than the pool, including the cost of administration, you're out, is essentially to try to get as many people in the pool as possible. This system works better, it functions better, and the savings are greater the more people that you actually have in the pool, spreading the risk across as many people as possible and improving the quality of the benefit you can buy at that price. And so fundamentally, that's, in the long and the short of it, what this bill is attempting to accomplish. Now, it's a lot more complicated when you get into the details than that real simple explanation. And you'll hear some people who will come in and say, well, we're already doing some of this, and it's a good system, and it ought to work, and you ought to allow for that competition to be there, and half the state may already be in a pool, it's already being operated. And you know what? That's a fair comment. I would simply just say that if it's good for half the people to be in a pool, why is it not good for everybody to be in a pool? And members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, in a day when the thermometer outside is 95 degrees, my closing comment would be, everybody into the pool.
Very good. Uh-huh. Any questions for the representatives? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great explanation. I appreciate it, and I apologize for being late. One of the things that you indicated was that 70% of the districts have responded to the questionnaires. Do we know what percentage of the potential employees are covered by those 70 districts? I mean, one group of 70 districts, it would be about 8% of the, maybe 15% of the employees. Another group of 70 districts, it would be 97% of the employees.
If I might, Representative Doyle and Representative Barnhart, that information will become available. In fact, at this point, you can log on to the Department of Education's website and take a look at the survey and take a look at the districts that have responded to the survey. And I do want to add that the cooperation and the work that's been done between PEV and the Department of Ed on gathering this information has been remarkable, and it really has been an example of how state government should work and how agencies should work together with each other, focused on a goal. We do have a good representation across all sizes and geographic distributions of districts. And as the information is compiled with the department and moves into the LFO realm to have some numbers attached to it, that information will become available. My intent, and I know that Representative Williams joined me on this, is to have both the policy information and the fiscal information be readily available to everyone that wants to have it. We want all the cards face up on the table, and an absolutely thorough and above board discussion on the issues, so that the bill that comes out of this process will be the best possible way to deal with the situation.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Beck.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps Representative Morgan could answer this. It was my impression, or I took notes, I thought, that indicated 70% of the school districts.
Well, that's very possible.
Yeah, it was not the number 70, rather it was 70% of the 198 who had responded. Which, so a pretty good percentage.
Yes.
A pretty good number of the total.
You know, the skew in the size of districts is such that the comment I made is still accurate.
Yeah, except I think that we had a good majority of the total number of students represented, or school districts represented.
Yeah. Good. Great.
Okay. Anything further?
That's fine.
Okay. Representative, one of the issues I think that probably is going to be the biggest focus for us is that this proposal actually does save the state money, or the district's money. And how do you recommend, you know, we find that information? Where are we going to be, you know, going to you know.
If I could, and then I'll let Representative Morgan, who's actually in charge of finding money, easier for me to talk about it and for her to actually do it. Let me say this. I think both Representative Morgan and I have been cautious and remain cautious about overpromising immediate savings, particularly in the 2003-2005 biennium, because of the time that it would take, obviously, to ramp this up. You've got school districts who have entered into contracts not only with the companies that are providing health insurance or the trust that they're currently contracted with, but also with their districts and employees through collective bargaining. And so there would be a ramp-up period of time before this thing were fully implemented, and I think you have to account for that in any kind of a strategy that you would put together. One of the challenges, obviously, that's presented by having 198 separate school districts doing different things is being able to put your hands on the data in a manner which can demonstrate that you've got all the data you need to evaluate the kind of savings that are going to be there. I think what the committee needs to do is it needs to listen to the folks who have evaluated this data, who have no axe to grind, really, in the discussion. and evaluate what they're able to bring forward and suggest to you would be the potential savings as you stretch it out in the long term. And then I think you need to listen to the people who don't like this idea very much and listen to their data and evaluate that and put it in context and come to some conclusion. I am fundamentally motivated by the common sense model that I developed for you in my earlier comments, that if you get virtually everybody into the pool, there will in fact result in savings. And I think the people within the industry who I've had conversations with on this subject and who I trust on this issue ultimately agree with that. Whether or not it's going to be 3% or 5% or 10% over some period of time, I think it's going to be much, much more difficult to determine. But if you're convinced by the evidence that's presented to you about the model and about the functionality of the model, I think you have to then rely on the likelihood that it will in the long run, and this is a long run proposal, that in the long run it will in fact produce savings. And the savings that it produces obviously are savings that we want to turn right back around and give to the districts in lower premium costs and providing a solid level of benefit. At the same time, making sure that as we're turning on the spigot at the state level to fund these programs, that you don't have somebody out there with runaway health plan options and costs and expenses while you've got somebody else over here who's nickel and dime and everything. I mean, the idea is to get control of an area that thus far has operated greatly outside the control of the institution that provides 70% of the funding for K-12 education.
I guess along those lines, I mean, just thinking of certain examples, I mean, we've been hearing over the past few months of one school district that's providing a monthly, or that has a monthly premium benefit of in the $840 to $860 a month range. And then you have like community colleges that are down to the $400 to $500 a month range. And I would have to expect, you know, there's going to be, if you bring more uniformity into that, you know, because the school districts are going to be experiencing the savings if they're at the higher end paying now. So, Representative Morgan, do you have anything further?
No, I think I just wish you the greatest good luck as you proceed through this debate, and I know that you do all recognize the importance of this as a policy decision and as a fiscal decision, and please consider that Representative Williams and I will be resources to you to the extent that we can do that.
Well, and I appreciate you wishing us luck, but I'm telling you, you're in this with us, so we're not going to let you off the hook. So we wish you as much luck.
Well, on that note, Mr. Chairman, both Representative Morgan and I have other committee responsibilities this afternoon, so to the extent that it would be within the chair's leave to excuse us to those responsibilities, and we'll monitor the hearing on the, we'll catch it on the videotape.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony.
Thank you very much.
As I had said earlier, Miley Christensen, asking Malia to come forward to discuss a little bit about the Public Employees Benefits Board, since the bill in front of you is a using PEB as a model. I thought it would be helpful at least to hear what they do and talk about, I guess, just the way that they administer the Public Employees Benefits Board. So with that, Malia, appreciate your coming in.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Malia Christensen. I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board. And as was mentioned, I was invited just to come and talk a little bit about PEB. So I have provided for you some quick slides that I think will do a little bit of a history, talk a little bit about the experience, and then perhaps end up with a brief discussion about what is pooling meant to PEB in terms of the history of the last 5 years. I must say before I start, the Public Employees Benefit Board has taken no policy position on House Bill 3639, so my comments represent the history of the board, but they're not meant to be in favor or opposed to the bill on the basis of the board's work to date. So with that, I know many of you are familiar with the history. In the 1990s, there were many conversations that took place about whether it would be a good idea or a not good idea to combine the two predecessor boards. Most of you are aware that the Bargaining Unit Benefit Board, known as BUB, had been in place since the early 80s. The State Employees Benefit Board, known as SEB, had been in place in the decade prior to that. The BUB program covered OPEU members who were represented by OPEU. The State Employees Benefit Board basically covered all other state employees, over a dozen other unions, all the branches of government, management, unrepresented employees, and all campuses of the Oregon University System, and at that time actually included OHSU. The 1995, Governor Kitzhaber appointed a task force. Then Senators Durfler and Representative Strobeck and members of both of the boards participated in a task force, which culminated in their recommendations to the governor that they proceed with legislation. And in the 1997 session, that legislation passed, and we started work in the late fall of 97, and actually PEB took action for the first time on January 1st of 1998. Much of the first 2 years was spent creating the new board, the new infrastructure. The predecessor boards had different philosophies, different rules, different approaches, different contracts. And so we inherited those programs and started on January 1st basically with what was in place for those two, and spent a great deal of time just getting our bearings and getting those programs continued so that the services would continue to be provided. We are now the largest employer-sponsored plan in Oregon. This year we will expend as a state of Oregon over $340 million in annual premium for this plan year. We provide an array of benefits which most of you are familiar with that include medical, dental, life, and disability, and a variety of other programs that are available to employees as well. The legislature actually went as far in Senate Bill 141 in the 97 session to give PEB a mission and also to ask that the board consider several things when making decisions related to contracts and benefit planning, and those are shown on page 4 of your slides. Succinctly, the legislative mission to PEB was to develop a high-quality plan of benefits that would be affordable to the employees and also to the state. The legislation that you're reviewing today mirrors this mission in terms of the outlook for the potential new board, and it also covers these same areas, which include things like competition and innovation, improvement in employees' health, a good retention and recruitment package, those kinds of elements. And the board uses these as guideposts to their decision making. The board is comprised of 8 voting members, 4 labor, and 4 management. So the complexion of the board and the bill that you're reviewing today is different based, again, on the population that's being looked at. There are 2 legislative members on the board who serve in an advisory capacity. So it's a 10-member board. In terms of who are the members of PEB, as was mentioned previously, we have about 110,000 members. We have about 45,000 state employees, their 65,000 dependents. We actually have over 20 semi-independent agencies that we provide benefits for, a little over 3,000 retirees who are not yet Medicare eligible, but they are PERS eligible, and they have a choice of staying in the PEB program and self-paying their benefits. We have about 500 to 600 of COBRA participants, and we also cover self-paid participants that have been grandfathered in by the legislature over time. These include OLCC agents, blind commission employees, postdoc candidates at the University of Oregon, and foster parents. And those were groups that were actually grandfathered in by the previous legislatures to the SEB board. How's the first 5 years been? Pretty doggone exciting. I was a lot younger when I came to the state in 1997. It's been a very good experience, and the next couple of slides just show you a little bit about what it is that the board and the state have experienced. Obviously, incredible market challenges began to occur and emerge at about the same time that the new board came into being. As many of you know, when we started this program in 1998, we, as I mentioned, inherited the programs previously. So we were actually managing 15 different medical plans and 7 different dental plans, 88 different contribution possibilities that were possible, over 125 different state agencies who were managing 2 separate programs, different programs. And over the course of time, the work of the board has been about developing a brand new approach to employee benefits statewide, which was introduced in 2000 with the new program. So for the first time, all of the state employees and their family members were offered the same plans. Quite a bit of development work went into designing models. At the time, managed care was an interest to the board as the most cost-effective and efficient way to proceed. The marketplace changed somewhat dramatically over the next 3 years, and currently for PEB, we offer a single statewide PPO plan that's offered in every county in the state. We offer an HMO, which is Kaiser, which is offered in the metropolitan areas, and we offer a small rural HMO, which has been a pilot program in the Pendleton and Hermiston area for state employees that are there. As I mentioned, we have definitely not been immune to the market forces, and the next couple of slides just show it from a number of different perspectives. The state of Oregon's average monthly employer contribution has increased from about an average of $386 in 1998 to a current of $647. I should note, and this is confusing a lot of times, PEB does not make the decision about the contribution. The contribution, the amount that the state spends, is made through a variety of processes, including the budget process, which you are part of, including the collective bargaining process, the Department of Administrative Services, and a number of different branches that can determine that contribution within their decision-making structure. So PEB decides the benefits, negotiates with the carriers, administers the program, makes the policy decisions, but the actual decision about how much is paid is made through those other decision-making processes. And sometimes a lot of people get confused on that point.
To check then on that issue, is there then further contributions from employees beyond deductibles and that type of thing, or is this covers that as well?
Mr. Chair, there are for the premium for medical and dental for active full-time employees in all of the circumstances across the state, those are fully paid for right now. Individual employees do pay at the point of service currently co-pays and co-insurance, but their premium is paid for in full at this point in time on a monthly basis. They can also purchase out-of-pocket for payroll deductions, things like life and disability, other kinds of services that we offer on a voluntary basis, long-term care that they also pay out-of-pocket for. The next a couple of slides, again, just continue to show the perspective, the annual premium increasing to about $340 million this year. That's sort of how does it look to the state. The flip side is how does it look to the employee. The next slide shows that as a result of the changes the board has had to make, the out-of-pocket expenses, and this is what I was just speaking about, for co-insurance and co-payments have also increased. And it was about an average of $400 per employee 4 years ago. That has now risen to about $800 per employee per year. And the reason for that is shown on the next page, and that's because as the board has adjusted and tried to meet its mission of balancing quality and balancing the affordability for state and employees, and they've made their changes in plan design, this shows a non-weighted average of the plan design for PEB starting in 1998 and ending up in 2002. And what that means is that balance has occurred. Employees have picked up more of the co-insurance, co-payment value of the plan, and this just depicts this. Really quickly, just moving to a couple of other comparators, we're frequently asked, and I think some of the previous discussion, and I'm certain that some of the discussion that will follow my testimony will be, how's PEB doing, and how do you stack up, and how do you look in the marketplace? And the next couple slides just show that in a number of different ways. On slide number 13, we looked at how did PEB stack up in terms of one of the surveys that was done by Mercer Foster in terms of average premium increases, and this showed up to 2002. You can see PEB is the white bar, National is the dark bar. PEB had a difficult year in 2002. In 2003, we did better than market at an 8% increase, and we have just announced this month our 2004 increase, which is projected at 9%. Most of the large employers in Oregon and in the region are projecting a 15 to 30% increase for 2004, so the board is very pleased that the preliminary increase has been a single digit, and that has been good news in a difficult series of years. Lastly, I'd just like to finish up with a couple of quick comments about pooling, and then I thought I might also add some issues about cost comparison. What is pooling meant for PEB? I think in terms of leverage in the marketplace, I would just add a couple of sub-points. Certainly lower administrative fees. PEB enjoys less than 7% of an admin fee from the carriers, and I think these are distinctions you'll want to become familiar with as you go down the path of looking at it. We've also enjoyed the flexibility and the opportunity to innovate. because when you have 110,000 members, people want to listen to the ideas that the board has about being creative or being innovative, and the board has been able to do a lot of things that a lot of smaller employers can't do because they just don't have enough mass to have that kind of response in the marketplace. I think there's also administrative efficiencies for the state. Clearly operating one board instead of two has made a difference. For state agencies that had to manage those programs side by side, it's just easier because there's only one. And the people that actually touch the employees have an easier time as a result. I think we've been able to offer an excellent benefit package in a very difficult marketplace. And we've also been able to communicate better with employees about all the changes, because there are not multitudes of messages about benefits in the healthcare market. There's a single message. And lastly, the board's been able, again, to continue its innovation by doing strategic planning about how to manage for the future. And the last slide is a very innovative vision that the board has introduced earlier this year, which hopes to achieve many things in the marketplace, most notably an innovative delivery system in communities statewide that will provide evidence-based medicine to maximize health and utilize dollars more wisely. And with that, I'll just conclude with one other thought. Earlier, Representative Morgans and Representative Williams were talking about issues of cost and comparisons of cost, and I think you'll hear a lot about that. I think one of the things that's important is to realize that it's really difficult to say PEB compared to any program or any program compared to another program, that the value or the dollar difference is X. And the reason is because there's so many variables. There's what's the plan that's offered. To what population? How well does that population do as far as their claims experience? Where are they located? What provider network do they use? What's the cost of administration? And I heard you ask earlier for some better clarity on numbers. And I think as the Department of Ed and the fiscal staff work on it, it's going to be really important to sort of weed through all those issues, because they're pretty complex and they are very informative. Okay. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions that
thank
I can.
You. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. How far ahead are you able to predict future years' costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we have modeling that we do that projects forward several years. That is based on our consulting firm's best estimates based on what the carriers provide us each year in terms of their estimates. Mm-hmm. And we've done fairly well in terms of our projections in previous years of where we think things are going to go. For example, our projection about this year's results was in the 10 to 11% range for next year. Once we completed the first several months of negotiations, we were able to get that to 9%. So we were pretty close to what we thought.
And the next year is calendar 2004. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. We run on a calendar year, so we start January 1st of 2004.
Okay, and then last follow-up. So you know now what the premium cost is going to be next year. Is that what you just said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we have the carrier's projections for keeping the status quo for 2004. The board will make its decision about what plan design, what carriers, what package will be offered on June 17th. But we know now, we've done all the work, we've done all the negotiation piece, we know now that the number to keep the status quo benefits is a 9% increase for 2004.
Okay, thank you. The reason I'm asking these questions is I'm thinking about how the time frames fit together for school board budget making and negotiations with employees about shares of costs. And so these are impressive numbers. I appreciate it.
Further questions? Well, yeah, just going back on that issue, I guess, in a way, and looking at that slide 13 that had the PEB versus the national average premium increase. And I mean, it's very encouraging that you're looking at that 9% projection for 2004. Not sure that I heard what the increase was for 2003, but I'm kind of looking at that 2002 number being such a high premium increase. It's almost like maybe,
25%
for 2003.
Well, I actually, and I apologize, because there was supposed to be an O3 slide in here, and I just realized that. I think I mentioned it. Our increase for last year was 8%.
8%.
8%.
So just looking at that high increase, the 25% increase in O2, was it maybe just where you and your board maybe anticipated the market a little better than others, that you know you took your hit with the big increase in O2 that's allowed only I guess these 8 and 9% increases for O3 and O4?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think there's a lot behind this, so I'll start maybe with the year that looks like the anomaly, which was 2002. We did that renewal, and the whole process was in 2001, so the decisions were made during 2001 for O2. Really difficult year. The projections that we had on the models did not look good for what we anticipated the carriers to respond to PEB. We did a national RFP during that time where we advertised across the country to try to encourage additional competition. We also had several carriers that had experienced significant losses on the plans. And again, I think part of what happened for PEB was it was large, it was new. We had those 15 different medical plans. There wasn't a great deal of certainty about what the board was going to do, how it was going to act. There were a lot of factors that played into it. There were also probably the most significant pieces on one plan in particular. There were significant losses, and that had to do with a number of different things, and I don't know that you want me to get into the detail, but there were many, many different factors. And so when we went to market, with experience that was not very favorable for the prior year, and that influenced the outcomes of the RFP. It influenced the increase for that next year. The board made some really significant decisions that next year to really consolidate the number of plans, and the reason for that was to try to get the risk issue mitigated and to make us a more favorable plan for the marketplace. And that's why I believe it's a culmination of issues. We reduced the surprise factor for the folks that were trying to predict what was going to happen. As Representative Williams mentioned, we reduced the adverse selection potential across these multiple plans by collapsing them into fewer offerings. Hard for employees because it meant less choice, but excellent for the overall program because it meant that our carriers could better predict what was going to happen for them. And so they were able to provide us with better rates. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. That's Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. You're prompting another question for me. There's a number of possible reasons why you could get a percentage anomaly like that. One of them is, of course, that your rates were particularly low before that and you're catching up. Could you give us some hints about how you compare in terms of actual cost with other comparable programs in other parts of the country or other programs in Oregon? You're giving us percentages here, and yes. I'm wondering about dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, one of the studies that was done over the last half of a year has been to look at the 10... in terms of size, largest government entities in the state of Oregon. So we looked at cities, we looked at counties, we looked at a couple of different school districts. And I would be happy to get that information. It's actually a report that was presented to the board. What it showed was, and this was a really important piece, is again, you have to look at the benefits. So you need to know what you're buying first. Are you buying a Camry, or are you buying a Hugo, or are you buying the Cadillac? And then you have to look at the cost. And what it demonstrated in this survey of 10 was that PEB had the highest level of benefits, but was able to purchase those benefits for about 5% less of market. And specifically in terms of our cost, the state contribution and the cost of the plan was also factored into it. And the $647 per month number is the number that is our number for O3, and I know that you heard earlier some of the numbers you'll be looking at for school districts vary from $400 and $500 a month to $800 per month.
And part of that's what you're buying, isn't it?
Correct.
Right.
That is correct.
Right. One more for me. It sounds as though this organization has developed a very large amount of expertise over the period of a number of years in the process of winnowing down the large number of programs and in simply going forward into the future. To what extent do you think that expertise could be available to a new program like the one contemplated in House Bill 3639?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, as was mentioned earlier, and I believe that Jim Sager from the Governor's Office is also going to speak to this, I think there's been a lot of collaboration in terms of activities leading up to it. We certainly have tried to be available from a technical perspective. Other consultants have been made available to the project. It's my understanding both of these bills are also assuming that they would be within the Department of Administrative Services, which is GORPEBA's. And I think that Mr. Sager and Gary Weeks, who is my boss, the director of GAS, are having some conversations about what's the potential in terms of looking at some ways to cover those bases.
All right, thank you. I'm asking the right person the wrong question, and I appreciate that. I would just comment, Mr. Chair, that the insurance, while I know a little about it, is not my area, and I may ask the same question three times to different people just to get it in my head, if that's okay.
No problem. Okay, thank you. Appreciate your help. Doug McKean. Now, colleagues, looking for Mr. McKean from Legislative Council to just walk us through this bill a bit, and hopefully, since he also had some work on the Senate bill as well, that he might be able to point out for us the differences between the two, and kind of leave it to the committee's discretion if you have questions through the bill presentation to go ahead and ask those questions. And I think at this point, even though we do have an amendment proposal by that's shown in the dash ones that were presented by Representative Montes Anderson that's before you, is that I would like to go through this bill, and then if there are some specific questions that haven't been answered that are contained in the dash ones, we can ask those at that point. So, Mr. McKean?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I'm just going to walk you through House Bill 3639, very exciting comparison with Senate Bill 6. I suggest perhaps you read along or look along, because I'll be referring to some page numbers and so on. As I compare the two bills, I think there are eight areas of what I consider a substantive difference between the two bills, and I'll try to point those out as we go through. As a little bit of background, Senate Bill 6 was drafted based on the PEB sections, which are in Chapter 243. And so Senate Bill 6 follows almost the order of the sections in the PEB statutes. This is the way they're laid out. A little bit of moving them around to make a little more sense, but we did really follow the PEB statutes. Then House Bill 3639 was based on Senate Bill 6, and I had the permission there to move the sections around a little bit more to make them make a little more sense, at least to me, in their flow. So while the same pieces are in both bills, they're in a little bit different order. I think House Bill 3639 flows a little better than Senate Bill 6. In House Bill 3639, Section 1 of that bill is the same as Section 1 of Senate Bill 6. No changes, that's just definitions. Section 2 of the bill is where the board is established and has the members. It, for the most part, is very similar to Section 2 of Senate Bill 6, except that the number of members is different. In Senate Bill 6, the governor appoints 10 members, and there are no legislative members. In the House bill, there are 14 members, which includes two legislative members, one senator, one representative. So the governor appoints 12 members in the House bill, and the difference between the 12 in the House bill and the 10 members that he appoints in the Senate bill is that in the House bill, he appoints a member representing community college boards to the OEB board, and the other board member is an expert. Instead of being two experts under the Senate bill, there's three experts in the House bill. There's another little piece that's different. In the House bill, of those experts, they can never have been eligible employees for purposes of a benefit plan offered by the board. That's something that doesn't exist in the House bill. So that's the first big difference, the makeup of the board. The legislative members are non-voting members, which is similar to the PEB board. So the 12 members are the voting members, and there are little differences throughout Section 2 that reflect that difference between voting members and non-voting members. Section 3 of the bill is very similar to Section 3 of Senate Bill 6. The one piece that's different there is on page 3, lines 20 and 21. That's a new subsection 5 of Section 3. And it says that at least biennially, the board shall establish a maximum cost per eligible employee for benefit plans provided by the board. That'll come into play later when we get to Section 15. But for now, just the board has one more little duty there. Biennially, they come up with this maximum cost per eligible employee. Section 4 of the House bill is the same as Section 4 of the Senate bill. Section 5 of the House bill, that maximum cost per eligible employee is the second substantive change of the 8 I mentioned. Section 5 of the House bill is the same as Section 8 of Senate Bill 6. Here's the third substantive change. Senate Bill 6 allows a district The board can allow for various kinds of supplemental insurance, life insurance, supplemental medical, dental, and other kinds of insurance. And in the Senate bill, it allows a district the authority to contract for those kinds of health plans if the board doesn't. So if the board doesn't provide for a life insurance policy, for example, the district can go out and do that on its own. The House bill does not have that piece. Section 6 of the House bill is the same as Section 9 of Senate Bill 6, dealing with long-term care insurance. Section 7 of the House bill is the same as Section 10 of Senate Bill 6, again dealing with long-term care insurance. Section 8 of the House bill is the same as Section 6 and 7 of Senate Bill 6. Those sections both deal with flexible benefit plans that an employee can choose that are among taxable and non-taxable benefits that are provided under the Federal Internal Revenue Code. And both those sections dealt with the same thing, so I put them together in Section 8 of the House bill. Section 9 of the House bill is the same as Section 11 of the Senate bill. Section 10 of the House bill is the same as Section 12 of the Senate bill. Section 11 of the House bill is the same as Section 5 of Senate Bill 6. Section 12 of the House bill is the same as Section 13 of Senate Bill 6. Section 13 is the same as Section 14 of the Senate bill. Section 14 is the same as Section 15 of the Senate bill. Section 15 of the House bill is the next place where there's a substantive difference. It's the same as Section 16 of the Senate bill with two big differences. In the House bill, there are two conditions on when a self-insured district, a community college district, or a district that has an independent health insurance trust may provide its own benefits. And there has to be two conditions met. One, the cost of the district's provided plan has to be less than a comparable plan that's provided by the board. And the second difference is that the district-provided plan has to cover the same employees as a comparable plan provided by the board. These are things that Representative Williams talked about earlier. So again, the cost has to be less, they have to cover the same employees for these certain districts that are able to opt out of board plans. And again, those districts are the ones that are self-insured or that have an independent health insurance trust or the community college districts. The second big change in Section 15 from the Senate Bill 6 version goes back to that thing I mentioned in Section 3, and that is that the district may not pay more per benefit plan than the maximum cost per eligible employee that's established by the board in Section 3. likewise, the district and its employees cannot agree to pay more than that maximum cost per eligible employee. So in other words, if the district goes out and gets an insurance plan on its own, not only do the conditions I mentioned earlier apply, but also they can't pay more than a district plan, and they can't agree with their employees to pay more than a district, but a comparable district plan.
Mm-hmm. Question.
Oh, excuse me.
Representative Barnhart.
Why don't you restate it, and then I'll see if I still have a question.
I should have said they can't pay more than that maximum cost per eligible employee that the board establishes back in Section 3.
Okay. Well, then I still have my question there. Why is that necessary if you've already got a provision that says that it has to cost less than the comparable plan offered by the board? I mean, presumably the board's plans are all within that limit, too.
Mr. Chair and Representative...
Isn't that surplus? Maybe I'm asking... I need to change the question if I'm asking a legal question. Would that be a different limit than the one we've already talked about?
Maybe. And I frankly am not real clear on that. The first one is the cost of the district's plan has to be less than a comparable board plan.
Right.
And then the second requirement that I just mentioned, the maximum cost per eligible employee, that is something the board establishes. And I'm not sure whether that would always be exactly the same as the maximum cost that the board would use when it establishes its own plans.
Well, let me ask a different question then, if I may. Does the board have to comply with that maximum cost that it declares biannually itself?
Yeah.
Or could it have a plan that costs more than that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I don't know the answer to that. The bill doesn't...
Bill doesn't say.
Bill doesn't say.
Okay. Thank you.
So that, in Section 15, that was the fourth and fifth substantive changes I see between the two bills. Section 16 of the House bill is the same as Section 17 of Senate Bill 6. In Section 17, this is the sixth substantive change. Section 17 of the House bill is really a transition section. It would be a temporary section of law to help get this new board going and to help districts get on board with the benefit plans during a transition. And so in Section 17, there are the same kinds of conditions on when a district can provide its own plan as we saw earlier in Section 15. So even during the transition, the districts couldn't get another plan or couldn't use another plan unless the cost was less than a comparable plan and they covered the same employees. Section 18 of the House bill is the same as Section 19 of Senate Bill 6. Section 19 of the House bill is the same as Section 20 of the Senate bill. Here's the seventh area where they're different. This is the section that describes the initial members on the board. Because there's a different number of board members between the House bill and the Senate bill, of course, they take offices at different times under this Section 19. They're three-year appointed for just 1 year, three-year appointed for 2 years, three-year appointed for 3 years, and three-year appointed for 4 years. Slightly different from the House or the Senate bill version. Section 20 of the House bill amends ORS 243.303. That is not a section that's in the Senate bill, so this is new to the House bill. And what it does is this section of the law talks about local districts or local governments providing benefits to retired employees of the district. In subsection 3 of that law, it allows the government to agree to pay part of the cost of providing benefits to retired employees under the bill. House bill is drafted. A district, a school district as we've defined it, would not be able to pay any of the cost of making health care insurance available to retired employees of the district. So that's the eighth substantive difference from the Senate bill.
Section one. Excuse me, you're saying I thought I heard Section 20 was not in Senate Bill 6.
That's correct.
But Section 3, the provision for retirees, is in Senate Bill 6? Or there is a provision for retirees in Senate Bill 6?
Section 3.
You're just talking about... Talk,
no, I think he's referring to
sub
the existing three. Statute. I think he's referring to the existing statute.
Oh, sub 3. Right.
That's correct.
Okay, of the existing statute.
I'm referring to subsection 3 of ORS 243-303.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I can't hear. Finally, section 21 of the House bill is the same as section 21 of Senate Bill 6, and it's an emergency clause. Yeah. And that concludes my comparison.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Yeah, just a question again on section
Anderson.
20. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way it's written in Section 20 now, I mean, the way it's in the House bill, a retiree districts can't pay for the health costs of retirees. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair and Representative.
And Senate Bill 6, same thing?
It's silent.
It's silent.
And Mr. Chair and Representative, Senate Bill 6 does not have this section.
So in
Senate Bill 6, a district could negotiate with its employees or it could just choose to pay part of the cost of retiree benefits.
Well, I have another legal question then. I think a bunch of districts already have a contract that says that they will cover their health insurance costs or some portion of them for retirees. How would amending the statute affect those contracts?
Mr. Chair, we can't draft a law that violates the obligation of contracts under the Constitution, so even if this changed, it could not violate any of those contracts. Once those contracts expired, then a district could not, in the future, after that contract expired, could not agree to pay any of the costs of health insurance for those retired employees.
Okay.
Thanks.
Dan?
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Greg.
Colleagues, I'm and Doug, I'm looking on page 9 at section 20. We had a bill in 2001, House Bill 2084, that was designed to allow retired local government employees to have the same premium on their health insurance as actives. There was some confusion, and that sentence that was confusing is on lines 16, 17, and 18 on page 9, because the insurance industry had a difficult time interpreting that one sentence. So after a work group or two and many efforts, we passed House Bill 2130 this session that eliminated the wording on lines 16, 17, and 18. So we currently have a law that permits local government retirees, and that's all local government retirees, to have the opportunity of having health insurance coverage at the same premium rate as the actives. So, of course, I would be very concerned if this bill or any other bill were to attempt to change that.
Ah. Okay. All right, one more. Just to be certain I've got this. This section, if it were adopted, would not prevent a district from offering insurance to the employee, but the employee would have to pay for all of it. Isn't that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnett, that's correct. There's a difference between whether or not you include your retirees in a pool with your active employees who are eligible for insurance, and the difference being and whether or not the employer helps pay for any of that premium.
Okay.
So this bill would simply say the employer can't agree to pay any of that premium, but the retirees could still be in the pool, and they would still get a premium that's the same as the active employees.
But they'd have to write a check for the whole thing themselves. Okay.
Further questions? Doug, just if you can, this is looking at the bill in total here. There's sometimes when we see, for instance, on page 3 and line 12, kind of a vague definition of providing a high-quality plan of health and other benefits. Other benefits, you know, under this section could mean anything. And then you've got further down... Let's see where you had a more specific description of what kind of benefits that could be provided. And I just lost it. Don't we have somewhere else where it's a little more clearly stated on what kind of benefits are provided? Maybe in section 10 on page 5?
Yeah, there's a number of places there. There's a description of various kinds of health, dental, and so on. More descriptive.
Can you just kind of give us the legal basis for using a broad term? I mean, could that be read differently than some of the specific terms that you have later on? Or how would they work together?
Mr. Chair, if you look at 8.1 in the definitions in Section 1, Subsection 1, Benefit Plan, a benefit plan is defined to include, it's defined very broadly to include medical, dental, vision, life. So that was the broad term. And so benefit plan is used throughout this to describe virtually any kind of benefit plan that the board might make available to employees, might be willing to contract for. So the phrase benefit plan is used in a number of places. Then there are other places in the bill where it's very specific. We're talking about a health benefit plan or a dental benefit plan or life or supplemental. I admit that both this bill and Senate Bill 6 were drafted quickly, and they were both drafted based on the PEB statutes. The PEB statutes were adopted piecemeal over many years, and I think maybe to some extent they may have been the remains of some of the PUB law and some of the SEB law that was all cobbled together to make the PEB law. And those sections are probably not a model of using uniform language. I polished that up to the extent I had time when I drafted the bills. Senate Bill 6, as I mentioned, was done quickly. And when I was requested to do House Bill 3639, it was done just as quickly. The kind of polishing that we might do otherwise hasn't been done.
Okay. Just down below there in Section 4, lines 26 through 28, directing the board to meet the needs and provide for the welfare of eligible employees in the districts, placing emphasis on these various items that are on lines 29 through 36. As I look at that, I see that generally the interest is focused on good quality plan at reasonable cost. I'm wondering, just maybe it's more of a policy issue than legal, but welfare of eligible employees in the districts versus having the state having taxpayers' interest in I'm sure this is just from PEB, but is there a
this is word for word by PEB statute. And I think that's exactly right. It's a policy call, how you want to balance the criteria. The criteria in Section 4, Sub 1 are referred to in other places where it's telling the board how to buy its policy or its benefit plans. So it's an important piece of this puzzle.
And then on the next page, page 4, in Section 6, talking about long-term care insurance plans, I think this is the only spot where we have the family member definition expanded to include parents of the employees. Can you explain that?
Mr. Chair, yes. This, again, is word for word from the PEB statutes. It includes the parent because I think one of the goals of the long-term care insurance plan was to allow active employees to get insurance to cover their parents when it's time for their parents to go into nursing care and assisted care.
So is it almost like they're reverting back to becoming dependents of sorts? I mean, but in this case, they don't have to be dependents for purposes of this definition.
I think that's correct, Mr. Chair. Section 6 and 7 are pretty much right out of the PEB statute. I think it's notable that those sections, the employee carries the full burden of paying for those. It's an optional, under at least PEB, it's an optional plan that the employee can buy the employer's not paying any part of that plan. So it's like the life or the disability. It's something that the employee can buy.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Further questions? Okay, thank you. Sure, we'll have you back at some point.
It's going to take a little digesting.
Okay. Mr. Sager.
Thank you, Chair Doyle and members of the committee. For the record, I'm James Sager, Education Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. I'm here today to speak in favor of the concept and the overall goal of House Bill 3639. While I do want to point out some differences and maybe go into a little more detail of what Doug was covering. But first, since Governor Kulongoski was on the campaign trail, he's been steadfast in his commitment to improve government efficiencies and control costs where possible. Our bipartisan efforts brought about major reform with the PERS system. But inside our public education system, another major cost driver to both districts and education employees is the runaway increase in health insurance. We want to help control costs to the benefit of both the employer districts and the education employees. The ultimate beneficiaries are Oregon's taxpayers, who again see our commitment to being good stewards of their tax dollars, and most importantly, the children of Oregon, who will see their classrooms and programs over time continue and hopefully expand. I want to make it clear that we really appreciate the efforts of Representative Williams for bringing this bill forward on the House side, Senator Deckard for bringing forward Senate Bill 6, and Representative Morgan for her work to pull various stakeholders together over the past several months to discuss this issue. Calculations have varied between $23 and $75 million per year that could be saved if we pooled education employees as we do state employees. But the governor feels that these dollars are worth pursuing so that we can have them directed to the benefit of our classrooms and our children. In addition, though, to savings obtained by eliminating commissions and royalties and small group administrative costs, additional savings can be obtained through plan design and streamlining, as Miley and others have mentioned to you. We're not saying only one carrier should have the entire book of business or trying to make any of those decisions, but rather focused plan choices to maximize usage and reduce the negative effects of adverse selection, again, as you've heard. If you will, I'd like to identify a few of the sections. Doug kind of mentioned them, but identify the differences that this bill has with the governor's version in Senate Bill 6 and kind of where we see it at this point. First was the board structure. We feel it's very important that the board have a balance of labor and management, whether it's 4-4 or 5-5. That's a decision as to how big you want the group to be. But as I currently read 3639, it's a 5-4 split of management to labor. And I don't know if that was just an oversight after listening to the presentation this morning or what, but we think that it needs to be a balance of management and labor on the board. The next question then is, do we need three specialists or are two enough? In Senate Bill 6, we say we thought two was enough, maybe three would be better. That's again, that's a decision to or a conversation to have. And last, with the board, in the PEB statute, two legislators serve on the board as non-voting members, and clearly with the state being the employer, that makes sense. So the question becomes, when in this case the state is not the direct employer, but in fact over 200 school districts and ESDs, et cetera, is it worth the expense to have two non-voting legislators coming to the meetings, et cetera? So that's something I think we should talk about. In Section 3 of the House bill, subsection 5, is the issue that says at least biennially the board shall establish a maximum cost per employee for benefit plans provided by the board. If this section is referring to setting rates, these are actually done annually, as Mylea mentioned, and we believe absolutely that is the responsibility of the board. But if this is a cap or something that might be something less than what the premium rate is, then that is an issue that should remain within the collective bargaining purview within the local districts. And we shouldn't put the OEB board in the middle of trying to make those kinds of decisions. Their responsibility would be to set the rates based on the best program they can negotiate with the carriers, as the PEB board does currently. They make that decision, and then collective bargaining determines inside that premium rate how much, if any, the employee contributes and the employer contributes towards that total cost. In Section 5, and I know that there's some confusion. Section 5 of the House bill is the same as, I think it's Section 8 of the Senate bill, but we, in the Senate Bill 6, we added the other provision, as Doug mentioned, which allowed boards to, if they come across a benefit plan or a benefit issue that they wanted to deal with for their employees, they would first go to the OEB board and say, gee, it's not on your list here of things that we can purchase through you. Are you thinking, you know, this is a new issue? It's kind of like when long-term care first came forward in the history of insurance, or we've had cancer care supplements and things added over time. If something like that comes up, the local districts would go to the OEB board, ask, are you planning on adding this to your list of options that we can make available to our employees? If the OEB board says, no, we don't plan on adding that, then and only then could the district go outside of the list of options to purchase through OEB to contract for the benefit of the employee, whether the employee pays it themselves or the district pays it. That would, again, would be up to whatever their local agreement would be. But to have the OEB board be the point of first contact, and if they say no, they're not planning on adding that, then it does give the option to the district to go and look elsewhere. In Section 15 of the House bill, again, this relates back to that Section 3 that I just mentioned, where we potentially set this different cap or this different dollar amount. And again, we just think that if this is really something other than setting the premium rate, that that belongs in collective bargaining. It shouldn't be dumped on the board's responsibility to also determine those agreements. Section 17 does require that all community colleges and self-insured or trust districts join the pool by July 4th if they're not able to meet the criteria of less costly for the same benefit. In Senate Bill 6, we allowed those groups to opt out of the pool, and there was some discussion around that in the testimony the other day. Our concern with the language in the House bill is that with the Taft-Hartley trust-type programs and the self-insured districts that we have, and there are four in the state, there may need to be a longer window of opportunity for those districts and those plans to evaluate their program and make whatever changes they may need to make in their plans to try and come into compliance with the restrictions, or determine, gosh, we can't, and therefore we choose to go into the pool. So where an amendment that was brought forth to the Senate bill the other day set a July of 2006 as kind of the end of that window, which is somewhat of a logical conclusion, because by July of 2006, as contracts roll and school districts move into the pool, that's about when most other districts, depending upon the terms of their contracts, would be rolling in. And so that would give those plans an opportunity to really evaluate who the things that they need to do in order to try and meet the requirements of cost and benefit.
Just to stop, can you just explain a little further a Taft-Hartley Trust District?
Well, for instance, Portland Public Schools has a Taft-Hartley type trust set up, again, where it's a labor management trust. It's these were federal regulations that this trust was set up back in 1977, I believe it was, and so they follow certain regulations. The trust itself actually then owns assets, dollars that are in there, and so there are not only do they have to go through a process of negotiating their premiums and determining by collective bargaining and, you know, a number of factors, but then there would also potentially be the issues of if they decided that they needed to end their program and roll into the pool, then there are the issues that they would have to deal with as to, well, how do you liquidate the assets, how do you redistribute them, et cetera. So our concern is that there are these kinds of issues that we should give those plans time to resolve or make the changes to their plan. Okay. The other group then...
Just to summarize then, to make to cure the issue you're concerned about here, you would simply change the date from 04 to 06.
Representative Barnhart, that was the direction that the amendment in the Senate bill was doing, was going from you're totally opt-out to having a closing the window from in 06. So that would be, seemed to me, would be a reasonable movement on this side.
I see. Thank you.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you. Jim, still, we're on the subject of Taft-Hartley Trust districts. A couple questions, really. Do you have an idea of how many there are, and do you anticipate any difficulty or, let's say, hang-ups to redesign and work with these plans?
There are four programs that I know of off the top of my head. Portland, North Clackamas, Crook County, and Medford. Districts are involved in either self-insured or trust programs. And again, that's why I raised the red flag, that having served on some of those boards in the past, I know that you have the asset issue, you have the plan design issues, and they're not only connected with the contracts that they've negotiated with the providers, but the contracts that have been negotiated with the individual labor unions inside the district. And so we're going to need time to review that and see what kind of changes they need to do and see if they're able to. Okay. Community colleges also fall under this, because in my work on this, I've discovered that there are a lot of different options that the community colleges fall under. Some of them are pooled with cities or counties. Some are part of different trusts that school districts are involved with, et cetera. And so, again, I simply raise the red flag that we may need to look at this and make sure that we're not having some unintended consequences and problems brought up by kind of this "you must" language.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, do you think the date July 1, 2006 takes care of that, or is something else indicated?
Representative Barnhart, I'm sorry, I haven't been able to do enough analysis on that to know that that date is appropriate, but it seems that doing it immediately is not. That's
okay.
About the best
answer. Well, of course, one thing to be said for that date is that if we chose that date, the next legislature could fix it if we were wrong.
True. And finally, is Section 20 of the House bill. This was not part of Senate Bill 6 because the governor does agree with the ORS 243-303 and the revised language that was he just signed into law in House Bill 2130. We want to make sure that local government which includes school districts, do make their insurance plan and the pool available for employees. Now, there was some discussion a moment ago about whether that meant just paying the premium or not, or whether they would have to self-pay. Our initial read of the language says that they cannot incur any cost in providing the plan. Well, that could mean then that we couldn't incur, or a local government entity couldn't incur the cost to set up or make it available, and how broad would that restriction apply? And so we think that by maintaining the current language in now ORS 243-303 is the appropriate restriction, and we need to make those plans available to the retirees to their benefit. In closing, again, I want to thank members of the House for bringing forward HB 3639. We have a common goal of providing education employees and employers with a quality insurance plan at a reasonable cost. This effort meets the governor's call for efficiencies and cost controls and will allow us over time to direct more dollars to the classrooms for the benefit of Oregon's children. And with that, I conclude, and we'll answer any further questions.
Further questions? I guess I'm curious, Mr. Sayer, just looking at these lists of concerns, and I understand that this concept has been worked on with legislators and stakeholders, the governor's office, for quite a few months. How did we get to two different bills here?
Chair Doyle, I'm not sure. But we definitely, I mean, I think that if you look at the goal, we have the same goal. The majority of the bill, of the two bills, are the same. We have some things that I raised today, I raised simply to kind of reinforce that these are the differences and we need to talk about them and kind of ask ourselves why. Others, like the retirement issue, is simply a difference, I'm assuming, in you know, the way we believe the policy should be established. And again, those just need further discussion and conversation as we move through the process.
Okay. I guess as I'm looking at this, I mean, I'm not seeing, you know, what would normally be a deal breaker between the two bills, I mean, to bring them together some way. And I guess I'm just concerned that if we, with that kind of a message coming out, that, you know, from my understanding at least, is that the House bill version was the one that everybody seem to be on board with as far as the concepts go, maybe with that exception of Section 20, and yet you know, we see a different version, you know, basically to come out in competition. It's on the Senate side. It just doesn't seem to make much sense to me to have two versions going at the same time when, you know, if there's nothing here that's really, you know, what the governor might call a deal breaker, then you know, seemed to me that we ought to be collapsing one into the other.
Chair Doyle, I don't think that this was a matter of competition. It was a matter of, during the course of the conversations, the desire on everybody to kind of get this into the system and get it moving and have the conversation begin so that, in fact, we have an opportunity through the legislative process to get this in place so that we can begin the development phase, which we hope can be in place by a year from now, which is going to require a lot of work. So it wasn't a competition. I think the differences have to do with kind of who talked to Doug and what, you know, what their concepts were, et cetera. And we, you know, we could have maybe finalized those better before the two bills were introduced. We didn't, and now I think everyone is open and willing to work to make sure that we do move these two towards a common goal.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Let's bring forward Craig Rossler, Tom Galke, and Michael Gray.
Good afternoon. My name is Craig Rosser, superintendent of Super Falls School District in Silverton, Oregon, just 10 miles east of here. And I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 3639 and the Oregon Education Benefits Board, unless significant financial savings can be shown for those school districts currently served by the Oregon School Board Association Insurance Trust. Kind of picking up on Representatives Williams' comment on the 95-degree day, there are already 204 school districts and community colleges frolicking in the OSBA Insurance Trust pool, and we're doing quite well. It's my understanding that the savings are not there, and I appreciate, Chairman Doyle, your comment that we really need to look not just conceptually at this idea, and it does need to be investigated, but we need to really see that there's some true savings for school districts. In the case of the Silver Falls School District, our contributions for health benefits are capped this year at $575 per month, just for teachers, and will increase to $590 a month next year, or a 2.5% increase. We are controlling cost. Both of these figures are significantly below the current PEB rates, and I don't know whether the number this year is $641 for PEB or $647, but I use the lower of the two. If we had been at the PEB rate of $641, there's a difference between our rate of $575 of $66 per month per employee. That equates out to almost $800 more per month or per year we would be paying for each of our employees if we'd been in the PEB-like plan. in the course of a year for our district, that equates to well over $200,000. We're a small district, 3,700 kids, but $200,000 in this day and age, in any day and age, really is a big number to us. It means teachers in the classrooms, it means middle school sports, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm certain you've heard many of those stories over and over again. So I guess one of the points, and probably the most important point that I want to make, is show me the savings. We want to see real hard savings for our school district. And if being thrown into a larger pool and some of our rates being increased to some sort of new state average costs our district's money, that is not a savings for the Silver Falls School District. And in the OSB Insurance Trust pool, currently 88% of the school districts have capped their insurance. The Silver Falls School District and its patrons value local control, and that includes not only determining the caps on insurance premium contributions, but the insurance carrier and types of medical plans. For example, in our school district, employees have voluntarily agreed to drop some plans and coverages, such as vision and orthodontic, to keep the cost of coverage within the reach of as many employees as possible. Will the same consideration be given by a PEB-like board, or by its very nature of its makeup and governance structure, are we more likely to see compromises and trade-offs? I must say, with all due respect to the sponsors of this bill, that the proposed PEB-like board has some disturbing similarities to the former PERS board. By the way, I served as a superintendent representative on the Representative Knopes committee on PERS, and I applaud the legislature for what it did in PERS. Personally, it impacted me, but it was good for our kids and it was good for our district. You did the right thing. I believe this sort of significant change deserves the same sort of very thoughtful, deliberative study and research. I'm not certain that's yet the case. I think we've got the cart before the horse in this particular instance. If the Oregon legislature, and I think you is committed to controlling bureaucracy and state-level administrative cost, it seems contradictory to me to support House Bill 3639, which calls for the creation of a new state-level bureaucracy and the retaining of up to 2% of the annual premiums that our school districts will be sending to this agency. Why the exceptions for some districts that self-insure or with an independent insurance trust? Why not the same latitude for districts with the OSBA insurance trust? I urge you to challenge the figures upon which the purported savings are based and to consider the wisdom of creating another state-level bureaucracy, a bureaucracy that, I might add, has a very generous monthly contribution by each of our local school districts for administrative costs. Thank you very much.
Do the other presentations first.
My name is Tom Gawkey. I reside in Albany, Oregon. Today, I will be wearing two hats in my comments in opposition to House Bill 3639. The first hat that I have is that of the Director of Business for the Albany School District. I've been in that position for the last 24 years. The second hat that I have is a board member on the Oregon School Boards Association's Insurance Board. I'd like to start with sharing my comments with my position with the school district. I need to also share that with my school district, I am not in the OSBA pool. We have purchased directly from Regency Blue Cross for at least the last 20 years. I have difficulty in understanding how this bill will save my school district any funds, any money. My school district for at least the last 20 years has established hard insurance caps with its employee groups. The establishment of these insurance caps has occurred through negotiations. Matter of fact, in 1986, the school district had a strike. So after that strike, we have tried to work collaboratively together. One of the trade-offs in the establishment of caps has been that the employee associations wanted to accept carriers and coverages. What we have noticed since that time is there has been significant modifications of plans to live within the limited funds that we have. So I have difficulty understanding how this is going to save my school district any money. I believe this bill will adversely impact my relationship that I have with my employees association. So I struggle with that, and it seems to look to me as a loss of some local control. I've also noticed over the years, and in particular the last couple of years, yes, costs have been increasing, but that hasn't been the fastest part of my budget that's increasing. What has happened with our hard caps, we have slowed that train down significantly. It's the other portion of the budgets where special ed seems to be out of control. And so I'm not sure this addresses my concern in controlling health care costs. Let me talk about my second position, which is that as a member of the Oregon School Board's Insurance Trust. I believe the trust has provided an effective cost control plan for coverages for school district employees. So I differ from that. The trust is very large. The board has made some modifications in the plans that it's going to be proposing for the coming year to help reduce costs. The one cost that I need to really share with you that I believe if you really want to control health care costs, and this is probably contrary where some of you may be, is would you change the statute that prohibits us from charging retirees not eligible for Medicare the true cost of their coverage? We're charging them basically by statute, my understanding is, what the cost of the active is. When I look at the trust, and I can first give you hard numbers with the trust, and I would need to go and gather the things for my local school district, but I've seen it in my local school district also. The OSBA trust currently of the number of retirees they account for by the number is 6.7%. But when you look at claim costs, it's 15.1%. And that's significant. That's, from my point of view, is one of the major things that is happening. And every time I go to the trust meeting or I go to my local school district and we're talking with the association and we're setting our rate, what we're going to do for the coming year, and we look at, whoa, what did the retiree cost us that he's really paying, and it's significantly more than what we're charging him. I'd like to close and thank you for taking the time to hear my concerns.
Hi, I'm Mike Gray. I'm an actuary and consultant to OSBA. I work with Mercer Human Resources Consulting. We're the largest employee benefits consulting firm in the world. The point that I want to make is that we looked at an example of the type of savings that might occur if this type of pool were presented. And this was done prior to the survey data being referenced, the survey data that's going to be coming into the Department of Education in the next day or so. Our concern is that that savings shows $65 million, but our understanding is that it's not based on any hard data. When we took just the OSBA portion out of that example and replaced actual OSBA numbers, the $65 million savings became $25 million of savings. Our point wasn't that we think this pool will save $25 million. Our point is that $40 million can disappear very quickly when you use real data as opposed to hypothetical data. And I think when you look at this data that comes from the Department of Education, it's going to be really important that you really get into the specifics of this data and understand it. Another concern that I have based on other groups that I've spoken with is that there is some desire to try to put the costs on an even footing. There are a lot of different benefit plans that are going to be compared together. And that makes sense from the standpoint of trying to understand what an overall cost would look like under one benefit program. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to an individual school district, because if I join a pool, and it possibly might even save a few pennies on administrative costs, if you increase my benefits substantially, I'm going to be spending more money. So the actual dollar spent can be higher in a bigger pool if they make decisions about plan of benefits or eligibility or what insurance company they contract with, or a lot of different decisions that are out into the future. So to say savings, that is still, even if you have a perfect survey of historical data, what school districts are spending right now, you still have to base that on what you think is going to happen with what this board is going to decide upon. And that's going to cost real dollars, not fictitious dollars. Just as an example, if the OSBA membership, 33,804 employees and retirees, were to be in PEB this year, that would increase the cost of school districts, for those member school districts, by $8 million. Now, I'm not saying OSBA is lower cost than PEB necessarily. I'm just saying that there are a variety of benefit programs under OSBA. And if they all went to the one program offered by PEB, and I'm using the Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield PPO as my example, even though PEB has a lot of advantages by being a large pool, it would cost money, hard dollars. Now, if you adjust that for benefits, there's an argument between PEB's consultant and our firm as to whether they're comparable or not. But in terms of hard dollars, there's no argument. It's $581 is the average medical premium per employee per month for OSBA. $607 is the average for PEB for 2003. So it's really important that when we start talking about savings that we really know what the numbers say and what the numbers have to presume in terms of plan of benefits and the operation of this program.
Okay. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the first question I have goes to... Now I'm lost here. Let me just ask you. Oh, to Silver Falls. Thank you. I'm finding my piece of paper here. Okay. To Craig. Is it Ressler?
Rossler.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Now, unless I misunderstood this bill, and I may very well have, mm-hmm. The bill doesn't specify how the insurance is to be paid for. As I understand what you've told us about your plan currently, is that you have obligated, the district's obligated to pay a certain number of dollars.
Right.
I'm assuming that employees also pay some dollars above and beyond that.
That's true.
Now, do you understand this bill to require the district to pay larger than the amount of its cap?
What I'm saying is if we were in the PEB pool right now and we had to pay the $641, yes, that would be my understanding. We would be paying whatever the new PEB-like board said our plan cost. And if it cost $641 a month, we would be paying more than our cap right now. Our costs would be driven up. So there may be some districts whose costs would be driven down.
Okay.
And there are other districts, and I would say you're going to be surprised at the number of districts, that we're going to see their cost driven up.
Okay, well, just to follow up on that, uh-huh. if I may, then it's your understanding of this bill that your current arrangement where the costs are shared between the district and the employees would go away under this bill, and the district would have to pay the entire cost.
That's my assumption, and I'm looking at the current PEB arrangement where it's fully paid at $641. That's my understanding for your medical and dental right now at the state level, or $647, whatever it is.
All right. Mm-hmm. Second question, if I may.
Well, if I can just interject, Mr. Russler, is there anything in the bill that you see that requires that? I mean, that it's only employer-only?
That's just an assumption I made.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Looking at the current PEB arrangement.
This is something I simply wasn't listening at the moment it was said,
mm-hmm.
and I'm asking, I think Mr. Is it Gilkey?
Gilkey
from Albany.
Yes.
You said that 6.7% of your total pool are retirees, and then you gave a percentage of the retirees' cost as a percentage of the pool, and I didn't get that number.
15.1.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Okay. Chair Dole. Yeah.
Representative Backlund.
Question for Tom on that last reference. Tom, how many retirees are there in your school district versus active versus actives?
I'd have to, I don't have that off the top of my head. We insure about 800. I've got to think here for a second. I probably have about 800 employees, and on my retirement list, I have probably about 100. Mm-hmm. It's probably my percentages or numbers.
I assume that. I thought perhaps your statement was a bit strong when you mentioned a real cost driver was the cost of the retirees, because I guess that the number of retirees would be pretty low relative to the number of actives.
But my retirees is the most fastest growing portion of my school district right now, with the number that are retiring because of PERS reform. And so I have a worry, and I've watched over the last few years that when we come to renewal for insurance rates, what the retirees really is where it's costing the district in relationship to what the active rate is. And so I just see that continually growing, and how do you control that? You don't. That's the way the dice rolled, and you're going to live with it. But if you really want to try to deal with that, that's a concern. And I'm trying to look at how do I see ways that possibly will save us money in the long run. I have hard caps, and so it's kind of, we have out-of-pocket significantly from up to $100 that people are paying right now. And so they're starting to make major modifications of how they buy insurance and what kind of plans they had. If you went back probably 10 years ago, you could probably describe our plans were Cadillacs. Well, the plans that we have now in place, if you ask the employees, they're all Chevys. But that's part of the times, and understand that. But I'm just struggling with, if one of the reasons for this bill is to save school districts money, I have a hard time seeing how it's going to save me money right now. Maybe down the road, but right now I don't see it, and so that I struggle with that.
Okay. Further questions? Okay.
Just a comment, if I may, Mr. Chair. I mean, I didn't ask any questions of Mr. Gray because I think I understood his points. But I would certainly agree that the most important issue that we face in looking at this bill are the kinds of issues raised actuarially. I mean, do we actually save money? Can we prove it? And I, for me, at least, that question is a wide-open question.
Okay. Thank you. For the benefit of the public, it looks like we're with the list of witnesses we still have remaining. We'll probably be going until it looks like about 3:15 this afternoon, because we do want to cover everybody who's listed, and we may have a member or two having to go off to another meeting. But I want to assure you at least that the testimony is going to be provided, and we will still continue reviewing this issue through additional hearings as well. So I'd like to bring forward now Tricia Bosak and Tricia Smith, and then after that we'll get the community college perspective, and then end up with Peggy Arett, yeah, at the end of that. So
Mr. Chair, yep. Members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. OEA represents 44,000 K-12 certified and classified employees, as well as community college faculty and staff. OEA is supportive of establishing a statewide health insurance pool for public school employees. Currently, elements and costs of health insurance benefit plans are negotiated district by district throughout the state. We believe a pool similar to the one put forth in House Bill 3639 would provide cost savings through consolidation of things such as administrative fees, elimination of most broker fees, provider discounts, and plan consolidation. Attached is some analysis provided to the OEA from Watson Wyatt and Company, a global consulting firm that provides information on health insurance and other employee benefits. If you'll take a look at that, I think it's been passed out to you. There are three charts. First, underneath the cover memo. What drew us to our interest in the health insurance pool was some of this information, actually projections out to the future, looking at what health insurance costs in districts is now versus what it'll be in three short years. So if you looked at modest increases of 10% or even up to 15%, which is not unusual, those increases aren't unusual, you can see that health insurance costs in school districts will exceed $1 billion by 2006. So that's the first chart. The second chart looks at the effect on employees and employers. If you look at the green bar is the employer portion of the cost, and the top part, the light blue, is the employee portion of it. So looking ahead to 2006, it's just looking at the 15% trend, which again isn't unusual, and some of the rate increases that we've seen shows a 52. It gets to a 52% total cost increase by 2006. 16% increase in district caps if you just assume that those caps go up 5% a year, with a 143% increase for employee costs. So you can see why this might have gotten our attention. I don't think it's out of the ballpark. The last slide was provided to us as an estimate by the actuary with Watson Wyatt, and this is the $65 million others have referred to. What the actuary did was take into account the premium costs and look at the components of that and calculated what savings might be in a pool when you cut out things like administrative costs and pooling costs for stop loss protection, those kinds of things, and that's where he derived that savings. So those that data is what got us interested in the idea of pooling, looking ahead to what our members face in the future. Our decision to support the pooling concept didn't come automatically, and it didn't come easily. It is a major departure from how our members are accustomed to doing business when it comes to health insurance and school districts. But after recent years of double-digit increases, more employer dollar caps, increases out of pocket for employees, elimination of some of the benefits just to bring down the cost of the plans, concessions in salary to maintain insurance, concessions in insurance to maintain salaries, you get the picture. We knew something had to change here. So school employees have struggled with all these dynamics as they attempt to maintain high quality benefits at affordable prices. So again, we do support the pooling concept to do things differently as it relates to health insurance. However, we believe it is essential that employees have a significant voice in how that package is put together and structured. Therefore, we suggest the following changes in House Bill 3639. First, around the composition of the board. We feel like employers and employees should have an equal representation on the board so that there is a balance of interests on that board that meet both groups' needs. As someone pointed out earlier, this bill includes member from community colleges represented on the board when community colleges may or may not be required to be in the pool. We would contend that one of those, that is probably a management position, and it could be rolled into one of those management positions that's already built into the composition of the board. So we would like to see more of a balance of interest on that board. Probably the key component that we would object to in 3639 has to do with the maximum cost per eligible employee. The whole idea of pooling is to mutually benefit both the employers and the employees in containing costs. Establishing a maximum cost per eligible employee won't really address costs for both, but it's really just going to shift additional costs to employees. That's obviously not what we are looking for when the premiums exceed those maximums. We see that the OEB's responsibility should be to secure good benefits at affordable rates and to set the premiums, and that the local collective bargaining process, that the rest should remain in that arena in which whether or not you share costs of the health insurance, that should be determined at the local level as it is now. Imposing caps from the state level will shift runaway costs to employees and will drive down total compensation. If their out-of-pocket costs continue to go up on insurance, they're going to look to bargain better salaries to help compensate for what they're losing on in that pocket. So you can take money out of one pocket and put it in the other. I think that's the kind of situation we have here. I think another question about this is, should the state artificially limit what locals can do, what local school districts can do around compensation? This pushes, if this would push school districts toward salary increases, because our employees would want to try to recoup some of their costs and higher insurance premiums through salary. And I think that it just pushes the bargaining in that direction. I think it's probably a natural flow of things. The exemptions that are included in the bill, I think it's clear that the conditions set up in the bill will drive all of those self-insureds and the community colleges into the pool, because I'm not sure that when you include costs around, it said bargaining, selecting, and administration of the plan, when you include all those costs, I'm not sure you have an equal comparison there. So if they want to put everybody in the pool, the bill ought to just say that. I think it kind of circuitous the way it gets at it. Finally, another very big concern is the retiree coverage. We see this as prohibiting districts from paying any of the costs, and this is the language in the bill, any of the costs of making health insurance coverage available to retirees of ESDs and school districts. We don't see why school district employees or retirees should be singled out among all other public employees as not having access to that coverage. So with that, those are our concerns with the bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Ms. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Stemp. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a union of nearly 20,000 classified and certified education professionals working in Oregon's K-12 districts, ESDs, and community colleges. First, we would like to thank the sponsors of the bill and the committee for moving this important piece of legislation forward. We have testified in strong support of Senate Bill 6, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 3639 with some changes that I will outline later in my testimony. We believe that creating a single public board responsible for crafting adequate and affordable health care packages for the more than 200 public education employers and their employees across the state is a common sense approach that can significantly reduce the huge costs we are forced to pay for health care. We believe this is the best opportunity you will see this session to actualize real cost savings in our education budget. And we believe, as we know you do, that this is something we must do this session if it's at all possible. We heard a lot of conversation during the debates over the PERS reform packages about how, as a legislature and as a state, we have to go after any savings that may be possible in our budget, including savings which may not actually realize, but just in case, we have to move forward legislation on the possibility that there is savings. We believe you have a far greater possibility to find savings in the provision of health care for public employees working in schools through this bill than perhaps you will find in the PERS reforms, but that's another issue. I only wanted to point out the similarity in the approach at trying to find savings in our budgets wherever possible and providing the services that we currently provide. House Bill 3639 is, as I said, an opportunity to reduce the cost of providing these health care benefits to our members, and many of our members today are being priced out of the opportunity to buy health insurance from their employers. Our members are predominantly classified employees. They're hourly employees. Many of them are part-time employees. And their wages are not sufficient to pay the ever-increasing out-of-pocket costs to pay for their portion of health care costs. If any of those costs are associated with unnecessary aspects of the provision of health care, such as administrative costs that could be saved, we would ask you to please help us in saving those costs so that our members can continue to buy health insurance along with their employers for their families. Currently, school districts and ESDs throughout the state are left on their own to try to provide these programs and purchase health care benefits for the employees. Many districts have not just one plan, but many plans for their employees, and that requires time, energy, and money in the district by their employees to shop for those plans, to put them together, and to offer them to their employees. We think that time is better spent educating our children, and we think that this single statewide board doing that function for school districts will provide the districts the opportunity to do what they do best, which is educating children. The cost, as you've heard, of providing health care benefits is skyrocketing. While many districts have dealt with their own costs by capping their out-of-pocket expenses, that you heard 88% of the districts so far and more coming all the time, that does nothing to reduce the overall cost of the provision of that health care. What that does is transfer the responsibility for the escalating costs to the employee. I would suggest that my members cannot afford that cost. And their salary packages are not reflecting increases that would be adequate to provide for those benefits. As I mentioned, I have members who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. More and more of them are becoming members of the health plan. We don't believe that that is a cost-efficient way to provide health care insurance for working Oregonians who are working in our schools. We think that House Bill 3639 is a far better solution to the escalating cost of health care than the system that we have currently in place. We think that is good public policy to reduce those costs whenever possible, whether the employee pays it or the employer pays it. And again, we think 3639 and the system set up in that bill does that. We do have some concerns with certain provisions of the bill, and you've heard about many of them already, and I won't belabor them any further except to mirror in my testimony the concerns that you've heard. Section 2, establishing the membership of the board of the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. We believe in House Bill 3639 provides an imbalance that can only provide trouble for the future. We suggest to you that the language contained in Section 2 of Senate Bill 6 is better language for providing a healthy working relationship on the board that ultimately will provide employers and employees the best bang for the buck in health care. We think Sections 3 and 15, incorporating new language compared to Senate Bill 6, which requires the board to establish a cap on the maximum amount of cost to be paid for employee plans by the board, is inappropriate to the function of the board, and it creates an unnatural dynamic that will be made up for in different ways at the collective bargaining table. We don't think the Oregon Educators Benefit Board would really have the ability to set a rational cap of employer costs on employee health plans for all 198 school districts and 20 education service districts throughout the state. That is an issue that school districts and their bargaining units can better make those decisions themselves. And remember, we're not just talking about the employees that are represented by bargaining units. We're also talking about superintendents and management employees that have contracts of their own. Again, we think school boards are in a better position to make those decisions along with their employees than OECD is. And so we would suggest that the language in Sections 3 and 15 be removed. And as with the governor and OEA and others, we have very grave concerns with the new language added in Section 20, which seems to prevent school districts from making plans available to retirees, whether or not the retirees pay for the plan. Districts, again, and the bargaining units make these decisions for themselves. When employees incorporate into a contract that they agree to language which allows the district to pay for a portion of a retiree health plan, they are doing that understanding that this is a total compensation package and something else will be less to make up for that benefit. And these are, these are decisions that should be made at the local level based on situations at the local level. And employers and employees who make those decisions are indeed making those decisions today quite adequately. None of these provisions are important to the main point of this bill, which is to pool school employees in a single pool for purchasing and plan design of health care. We support that concept very strongly. We do hope that you will move this bill with the Dash 1 amendments, which Representative Mark Anderson has been kind enough to draft, which take care of the concerns that we have. Today would be a fine day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, since there's no work session scheduled today, it won't be today, but...
Tomorrow. You've got an hour notice.
That's right. Well, where are we now?
I'm available.
Okay. Good to hear. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having trouble understanding the argument over Section 3 and 15, the cap, the cost cap, I'm having trouble seeing that it does anything as compared to once you put it up against other sections. What do you think this does that you would object to? I'm simply having trouble understanding how this is different than the other requirements in the bill that establish caps on costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think the confusion is the difference between a cap and a premium. The board, the job of the board is to, as I said, market and purchase health care plans and establish premiums for districts. Districts and employee bargaining units together determine how much of the premium cost the district will pay and the employee will pay. The district's portion of the premium cost is what we call the cap. The district will pay up to X part of that premium. That's the cap. And that's the part that we don't think is appropriate for OEBB to establish. It is important and appropriate that they establish premiums, the rate that the district and employee must pay for the insurance. But the cost division within that premium should be determined at the local level. And that's what is contained in sub 5 of Section 3. It requires the OEBB to establish that employer portion of the premium. And then Section 15 requires the district to pay no more than the amount that the OEBB set in Section 3.
Right.
So that's the thing.
Well, I appreciate your interpretation. I don't read it that way, and I may just simply misunderstand what it means, but it doesn't say that directly, at least, in the way these two sections are drafted. And I know you have an objection, but I still haven't figured out what it is, because in the second sentence of sub 4 on page 7, lines 27 through 29, seem to combine the employee, the district and the employee, or the exclusive representative of the employee together may not agree to pay more per eligible employee for the benefit plans than the maximum of cost per eligible employee established by the board under Section 3. So, I can see why if it were to say this is the premium, but Section 3 of 5 says the boards can only pay that much, that would establish an automatic cap on what boards can pay. That isn't what this seems to say, at least not the way I read it. Now, do you read it the way I was just saying it, or some other way?
Mr. Chair, we interpret the language to be addressing the employer cap on their portion of the premium payment.
Okay. Now I understand your objection.
Right.
Thank you.
And if, may I add, Mr. Chair, that if Representative Barnhart's interpretation is the correct one, that this is only addressing the premium cost for these health care plans, that the board establish a premium, I remove my objection, because we believe that is the appropriate place to establish a premium. But then the cost-sharing factors would be decided at the local level. How much the employer pays of that premium, how much the employee pays should be decided.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well,
thank you.
So that's an area of clarification, it would seem to me, Mr. Chair, that we really do understand what these sections actually mean if we decide to pursue the bill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good point.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And Andrea Henderson, we got, looks like, three folks from community colleges. Yeah, beside yourself, Mr. Wagner, Mr. Donnelly, Mr. Dembro. Do you know those folks? Okay, so the other folks are... Hi. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon. We're here today to share some of the concerns we have on this House bill and the potential for additional costs for community colleges. Now, essentially, our colleges are concerned that the passage of this bill will increase the cost for health care coverages for our community colleges. We have a couple of specific areas we would like to address. First, we did ask our colleges to take a look at the current PEB benefits and to compare the current plans that they have with the PEB plan and to compare the different rates to see if there would be any cost savings or additional cost incurred under that program. After all, 17 colleges did look at the PED benefits. Not one of them was able to say that they would have any cost savings if they were to move to that particular plan. Recognize that whatever plan that this new board will come up with will not be identical to PED, but did take that as a point of comparison. Secondly, our colleges are concerned because the bill as currently drafted defines the eligible employees that would be covered by the health insurance benefits. This definition is potentially broader than the eligible employees currently covered by the colleges, and our colleges are concerned that that could have increased costs for them as well if they had to cover additional employees that they're not currently covering. I have with me Jerry Donnelly, who is the Human Resource Director for Portland Community College, and also this year is the Chair of our Human Resource Directors Committee in Community Colleges. And he will be able to talk in more detail about, specifically at Portland Community College, what the impact of this bill would be.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Donnelly. I'm the Director of Human Resources at Portland Community College. I'm here today at the request of OCCA to testify about the concerns that we would have about the implementation of the bill, but I need to say for the record that our board of directors has not taken an official position on the board, on the bill, excuse me. So just with that in mind, what I'd like to talk about are the issues that we see that this would raise. And as has been noted in much of the earlier testimony, there are significant differences here in how this plays out compared to the Senate bill. The two significant issues that we see, even recognizing the opt-in, opt-out feature, which isn't quite an opt-in, opt-out feature in this bill, it's actually sets a series of conditions that we think would be a very high hurdle for us to pass, that, as the representative of OEA, I believe, stated, would effectively require community colleges to participate because we won't be able to meet those tests and those conditions. But the two things that, assuming we could opt out, that still concern us are the implications for collective bargaining and the impact and viability that on the viability of the OSBA Insurance Trust. Currently, 12 of the 17 community colleges participate in the OSBA Insurance Trust as a means of providing health care insurance to their employers. PCC is one of those. We also offer our employees a Kaiser HMO option in the Portland area. But we're concerned that the overall impact of the bill of moving all of the K through 12 districts out of the OSBA pool will so reduce the size of that pool that it will lose its effectiveness and its viability, and that even if we wanted to opt out, we would not be able to because there would not be an option available to us. And I would say, though, we have had differences of opinion at times with OSBA about various issues about our insurance plans. We do feel that the OSBA plans are offering us a good deal at this point. The viability of those plans is important to us. And if they're not available, we would have the choices only of either going outside independently and shopping for insurance or moving into this plan. The requirements, as I said, are high, and we think that if we had to go out and shop for our own insurance, we would not be able to meet those. We would end up being forced into the pool, and the issue of choice then it kind of goes away. The second concern that we have is relative to collective bargaining issues. And I think the most generic statement of this that you've probably heard numerous times is local control issues. To address some of the points that have been raised earlier, I too read the language in Section 3 and Section 15 as requiring a cap be set at the OEBB level and taking that away from individual employers and their unions to bargain those caps. That was my reading, consistent with Ms. Smith's reading earlier. There are a couple of other things. There is, in Section 15, Paragraph 3, the statement, quote, "A district is obligated to bargain with employees of the district or with the exclusive representative of the employees concerning the amount employees must pay of the district's cost for benefit plans." That two that there's two obligations to bargain there, it appears. One, with exclusive representatives, who would be the, under PECBA, would the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, would be the designated representatives for any unionized employees in our districts. The second seems to imply that we would have a new duty to bargain with employees who are not organized and who are, in fact, in some cases, barred from organizing by PECBA. So I think there's an inconsistency in that language that that I would be concerned about. There's a similar implication on the issue of the long-term care benefit, which is in Section 6, Paragraph 3 of the bill, where it also sort of parenthetically notes on the issue of long-term care that it's subject to negotiated agreement. Now, currently, PCC, among many other organizations, does provide a long-term care plan which is available to our employees entirely at the employee's expense. This is not something that we have seen as a mandatory bargaining item, but the addition of that language specifically in this bill, I think, would probably be read by the labor representatives to make that a mandatory subject of bargaining. And frankly, we have enough issues on the table without having to worry about bargaining for parental insurance care. That's one of my concerns. The bigger issue for us is the scope of employment that is defined as being an eligible employee. The bill parallels the existing PEB statute in defining eligible employees to include anyone who is half-time or more, though it doesn't define half-time. PCC currently has employees, and we have a number of different categories, as you might imagine. One of those large categories is our part-time faculty. We currently have, through our collective bargaining process, established I'm going to call it a healthcare trust fund, though I want to make it clear that it's not the kind of trust fund that was being talked about earlier. It doesn't fit the Taft-Hartley definition, and we don't. The fund doesn't actually purchase insurance. It's a fund that the college pays currently $100,000 a year into that is administered by our faculty federation for the purpose of providing a partial reimbursement to part-time faculty who meet certain eligibility criteria for their own out-of-pocket costs for having purchased their own health care insurance. So that's the method that we have set up to try to deal with this. So effectively what we do is we make available a pool of money that can be divvied up among those employees who meet those criteria. This bill would require us to cover all faculty, part-time faculty, who work more than half-time. There is no definition of what that is in this bill, nor in Senate Bill 6. And that is somewhat troublesome, since part-time faculty are generally hired on a term-by-term basis, though many of them do end up working on a consistent basis over some long period of time for the same college, or they work for multiple colleges. Not having a clear definition there makes it difficult for us to know exactly what we would be getting into if we opted into the pool. Initially what I did was I looked at if we took our current spring term only number of part-time faculty and assumed that 50% of those are working at half-time or more based on a faculty FTE workload kind of calculation, the number of faculty that I have working this term is part-timers is 1,148, and roughly half of those would probably fit that criteria. If we were to do a proration against our current cap, which for faculty is $420 per month, if we did a proration of that to half-time at $210 and multiplied that out by that number of eligible part-time faculty over a four-term year, just on the cost of part-time faculty, we've just added more than $1 million in cost to PCC's budget for benefits. If the law actually goes in with the PEB, the OEBB being able to dictate what the cap is, and we have a cap that we have worked hard at, and we have bargained hard over this for many years with the Faculty Federation, The potential of having that cap float to a higher level for all employees means that not only do we have this $1 million additional cost because of the expanded definition of who's an eligible employee, but we also have the added cost of whatever that increase in our cap would need to be. And that would be very substantial. We did a rough estimate, again, based on our initial look at the at PEB as a comparator. And if we were paying the PEB cap for all of our employees on an annual basis and doing this prorated basis for all of our part-time staff, the additional cost to PCC would be approximately $4.5 million per year. So this is a significant impact to us. Now, PCC is in a situation because of our size where if we were to opt out of the plan and shop for other insurance, we might actually be able to meet some of those conditions. It's possible. We have looked at the option of self-insuring in the past. That would be another possibility for us. I'm also very concerned, however, about the impact on other community colleges because they have proportionately smaller numbers, but also they have the same kinds of issues around part-time faculty. So it's a significant issue to the community colleges that isn't specifically addressed in the bill. If I could just quickly move on to a couple of concluding points.
And make it very quickly.
I will. These items also have been discussed, so I won't belabor them, but the language on retirees in Section 20 I think is very confusing. It seems to imply, on the one hand, the existing statutory provisions about being able to bargain that, and then that there is a bar on it. The explanation that legislative counsel gave was helpful in clarifying that today, but I certainly don't read the statute that way, and I think that it needs to be clear if the intent is actually that there would be an end point on such agreements in the contracts. As contracts expire, they could not be renewed. I don't believe that that's clear in the way the statute is being proposed. Thank you, and that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Monsanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have to be a member of OSBA to take advantage of their insurance trust program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monsanderson, I think that would be more appropriate a question for OSBA. I'm not sure what their requirements are.
We got nods. Okay.
Collected nods.
Each follow-up, please. And each time, each year that you have to, or whenever you bargain to set up your, let's step back. On a yearly basis, do you go around and shop around to see if there are good deals on insurance plans, or do you just automatically choose OSBA's plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moines Anderson, we do not shop annually. We have shopped periodically to see whether or not we would be able to find comparable insurance at a comparable cost. We've not been successful in doing that, partially because one of the pieces of participating in a pool such as OSBA's, and this would be true in the future with pools under the OEBB, is that employers do not have access to individual information on their claims experience. And that's something that if you don't have that when you're shopping for insurance, anyone who's bidding on your insurance offerings is going to, in effect, bid blind, and they're going to bid without having benefit of knowing what they're really expecting. So it's a difficult circumstance in which to bid. We have attempted that with portions of our benefit plan in the last few years since I've been Director of Human Resources at PCC, and we did not get successful bids.
Okay. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
Rob Wagner and Michael Dembrow. So, and colleagues, after this panel, we just have one more witness, so looks like we still have a few more minutes.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, and the remaining members, usually at this point of a 2.5-hour committee meeting, I usually say that we're batting cleanup, but I guess in this term, since we're talking about pooling, I'll say that we're the last divers on the platform. Okay. Just briefly, I'm going to talk very briefly, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague here, Mr. Dembro. AFT, we're representing AFT Oregon, who represents 10,000 employees in the state. The folks who are most directly impacted by this bill would be our classified employees in K-12 school districts across the state, as well as our faculty and classified at community colleges as well. I do have printed testimony that I'll hand out, and you can read it at your evening leisure, perhaps. I won't talk to it right now. I will just say, in terms of the specifics of the particular bill before this committee, we would parrot some of the concerns that were mentioned by Jim Sager, the governor's office, and would say that we're also supportive of the Dash 1 amendments. So I'll hand out the testimony, and then I just introduced Michael Dembro, who is a faculty member at Portland Community College and is president of the Faculty Federation, and has been teaching for over 20 years in community colleges, to talk about a couple elements of the bill as well.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michael Dembro. I teach English at Portland Community College, which I've done since the early 80s. And then in my spare time, I'm president of the PCC Faculty Federation, which represents about 2,000 full-time faculty, part-time faculty, and academic professionals. And I've been intimately involved in the bargaining process through the Federation since about the mid-80s. You know, since that time, I mean, since we've been bargaining contracts, our major concern has been trying to get the best coverage for the most affordable price. And we at PCC have always been conscious of cost containment. We've had a cap since I've been there. And so we have been concerned about, you know, sharing costs and keeping the costs down. And this legislation, as I read it, is not about caps. It's about cost containment. And if the legislation can help us in our quest for getting decent coverage at the lowest price, then I'm all for it. And I would really thank the framers of the legislation for taking this on. It's difficult. Bargaining has become so difficult for us because of the health care issue, and I think others have spoken about that. One of the advantages from our perspective in this legislation is about 180 degrees different from the what you just heard from the OCCAs, because we think that it really is a good thing that this plan would cover potentially people who are teaching 50% and above. The colleges right now are very heavily dependent on part-time faculty to do their work. These people do great work, and they do it at, you know, for not very much pay and for very little access to health care benefits. Jerry Donnelly told you the story of how we have set up a reimbursement plan for part-timers. I need to tell you a couple of things that he didn't address. You know, one is that we have been looking for years at the possibility of coming up with a group plan for the people, you know, for the part-timers, and under the OSBA system have not been able to do that. And that's, you know, the college has told us, you know, we would love to be able to do something like that, but the OSBA won't let us do it. And so, and yet we're also constrained from going outside the OSBA because of the problems with our benefits history, the claims history that Mr. Donnelly alluded to. So we have set up this this reimbursement pool system, which, just to clarify, part-timers have to buy their own insurance on the open market. Very expensive, very poor coverage. You know, for the most part, it amounts to a kind of major medical sort of plan, and they're reimbursed, you know, a small amount of money for that. Of the number of part-timers, he's right that there are potentially 1,100 part-timers each term. The number that are applying for that reimbursement are about 150. So, you know, the number, the cost to the college, he was calculating it on the absolute potential outside, but really the numbers that are that would apply for this are much, much lower, because, you know, it still would be part-time coverage. I mean, they would be reimbursed on a part-time basis, it would still be very expensive for them. But for the people who would be eligible and would pay that amount, this is their only chance to get decent health care coverage. So it's very, very important for these people. And, you know, it really seems I hear there's going to be some an amendment proposed that would exempt the colleges from having to include these 50% and above people. And I would really urge you not to go along with that because, you know, it's not fair that other employees who are working half-time would be eligible, but community college faculty who are working just as hard, I would argue, at least as hard as half-time people elsewhere, you know, are stuck without decent health care coverage. And then finally, I just want to close with, you know, again, returning to this question of the cap. I think that if the colleges or school districts are trying to calculate the cost savings based on, by comparing the premiums of PEB versus the cap, I think that's a very specious argument because you really need to look at total compensation. That's how we do it at PCC. We look at the benefit, the amount that you get for you know under the cap, and the total and the amount of salary. The more that the insurance costs go up beyond the cap, the more we are forced to bargain for higher salaries. If there's not a way to keep those costs down, that the demand for higher salaries is going to go up. The needs of the colleges in terms of the money they need from the state is going to go up. We need, you know, we really need to control those. To argue that all these costs, the any rising costs, you know, the employees are going to bargain to their own advantage. Well, that's a dream world of bargaining I would love to be in because, you know, bargaining is all about compromise. Those are my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Peggy? All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. I will be very brief, knowing how long you've been here. I just wanted to make a couple of technical comments on the bill draft that you have, and the same issues exist in Senate Bill 6. Most of the discussion you've heard today is focused on the concept of pooling. I understand you will take a look at the assumptions and the cost calculations. I suggest you look equally at some of the technical provisions in the bill as suggested by Representative Doyle, because the issue that you have with some of the language in the bill is you may be restricting this new board's, if it should come to be, ability to manage program costs in terms of plan design. There are some provisions in the bill that already would represent the technical term in insurance, adverse selection, which would allow people to move essentially between panels of providers at will. There is also another provision in there that allows freestanding dental coverage for retirees. So when you look at the bill, you need to look at the bill to be sure that there is enough room to come up with alternative lower cost plan designs, as well as the plan design that the individuals can actually afford to pay for when they're active. And I think that I only wanted to bring that issue to you because I think intuitively some of you were actually going in that direction in terms of the questions that you ask. And I will also just finally comment, I happened to be around when the early retiree law was passed that affects local governments and was the administrator of the League of Oregon Cities program at that time. There are huge issues surrounding retiree coverage and how they're handled within the public sector arena. And I would also urge you to pay some special attention to the language dealing with retirees so that you understand it before any determinations are made in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I'm wondering if
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm wondering if it would be possible for you or perhaps somebody else to provide us with a list of the areas where you think that these concerns lie in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
I should add that there are a group of carrier types that have looked at it, and we're all more than willing to sit down and come up with that sort of a list.
Thank you. And Peggy, I apologize for mispronouncing your last name as well, for misreading it. Colleagues, we obviously we're just concluding the public hearing on this, but I do want to encourage you and those who testify today to make sure that your comments and your concerns, if they are not in writing already in the form of written testimony to us, that you get those comments and concerns primarily to our committee administrator, Megan Palau, or to my office, and we'll start putting those issues together to make sure that ultimately over the next couple of weeks we can start crafting a bill, I think, with those concerns addressed. And for the members as well, if you have issues and concerns, that make sure that we can get those into our administrator or to me.
Mr. Chair, the Dash 1 amendments addresses concerns that the proponents of the bill have, but they don't address the concerns that the opponents have. And the other thing that the amendment does not do is there was an issue regarding changing, because of the trust, changing the date, so that is a change that would need to be made, too, from 2004 to 2006.
Okay. Very good. Representative Barnhart.
And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the work that's gone into this, and I'm extremely intrigued by the idea. I had a bill of my own that would have allowed school districts to buy into PLEB. It would be was a much less ambitious bill than this one. The deal breaker on this is whether or not it really saves any money. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we have to be the most careful about ascertaining. We have gone through systems in which we've been disappointed by hypothetical savings or hypothetical changes in other budgetary discussions we've had, and I would hope that whatever we do, we act only when we're pretty sure that we're going to save funds, in addition, of course, to preserving and maybe improving the insurance products that are available to our school districts.
Okay, very good. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3639. And one final note, colleagues, looks like we're going to be looking for an extra day next week to start meeting at least three times a week for a while. So I'll be asking Kara to get to you folks to see what's a better day for you to do that. And with that, we are adjourned.